What happened was Detective Lou Smith from Colorado Springs worked on the case, looked at the case, and told Boulder police he thought it was an intruder. Lou Smith did not think it was the Ramseys that were involved.
Lou went to the grave wanting to find the killer, Jean-Benet. You know, Lou kept a picture of Jean-Benet in his wallet to the day he died. This was important to Lou. Lou knew that someone came from outside the house and killed this small child on Christmas Day. It's unthinkable that this person still walks free.
The case was getting further and further away from being resolved for little Jean-Benet Ramsey.
Welcome to episode 5 of The Killing of Jean-Benet, The Final Suspects. I'm your host, Danielle Robay. Last time we learned of two early suspects identified by lead detective Lou Smith, JonBenet's photographer, Randy Simons, currently incarcerated on child pornography charges, and local man Michael Helgoth, who died in suspicious circumstances in February 1997, just hours after Boulder District Attorney Alex Hunter claimed to have been close to a breakthrough on the case. Now we're going to meet a key figure in our new investigation, Lou Smith's daughter, Cindy Mara, who has inherited her father's case files and his final list of 10 suspects for the murder of Jean-Benet. Our team leaders, investigative reporter Doug Longini and Jean-Benet expert Jameson, met up with Cindy to pool resources.
I'm Cindy Mara, Lou's daughter.
I'm Kent Mara, Cindy's husband.
Tell me a little bit about your dad.
He was the most humble, hardworking, thoughtful person you'd ever meet. You couldn't find one person that would say a bad word against him. And at the time, you know, I think everybody thought already that it was one of the Ramseys. That was just a given. And I do remember that after he worked for about a month on the case or so, I remember talking to him and I said, so who did it, the mom or the dad? And he goes, I don't think either of them did it, because I don't think it was a family member. I think it was an intruder. So by then already he knew. He did his homework and he knew it wasn't them. He spent a great deal of time and money trying to find who killed this little girl after he quit with the DA's office. He just did it on his own.
And when the did on your own, the work, what did that include? Did it include research? Did it include phone calls? Did it include?
Very much. He talked to anybody who wanted to talk to him, anybody who had a tip, anybody who wanted, you know, to give their support to him, he would always talk to them. But I think, you know, the majority of it, he spent hundreds and hundreds of hours putting together that spreadsheet and putting together the case files, going through those case files, just organizing it all, you know, figuring out what was there, cross-referencing, having my brother, his son, come up with a program, you know, code a program so that he could keep track of all of the information, cross-reference it. That's what he spent his time doing.
Thousands of hours, not hundreds.
Yeah, thousands.
I mean, just...
It consumed him.
It did. Every night.
Every night he'd be working on it.
Every day. You could always go over to his house and he'd be in his office. Where he had a Christmas tree that was in memory of JonBenet. And he had JonBenet's picture on the wall. And that's what he did. He had binders with her picture on it. And he just organized it. He looked at it. He tried to figure it out.
As Cindy explains, for her at least, tracking down the killer is not just about finally finding justice for Jean-Benet, but also a deeply personal mission.
So he has this list of suspects. And unfortunately, at some point, he becomes ill. And he recognizes that his days are numbered. How does he deal with that?
Well, you know, I remember, I remember that Kent and I were in the hospital with him, and he just said that he, you know, he wanted this case to continue. He wanted to keep looking, you know, just keep looking. And he gave us a name. He said, I want you to write down this name and start there. And so I did. I got my, you know, I wrote it down. He gave me the name, and he told us to start there. And then... When he ended up in hospice, which was just a couple of weeks later, he was really rallying anybody that he could to continue the case. I mean, the last day I remember he was, you know, pretty unresponsive, but probably the second to the last day. He just, you know, urged us to continue the case. And, I don't know what else to say. He asked everybody.
It was his dying wish. We just can't forget that. So that's why we do what we're doing.
Cindy describes how in the decades since her father died, her team has been continuing his work.
What is the spreadsheet?
Yeah, the spreadsheet is really his database, I guess you would call it. And it contains a lot of columns. I mean, spreadsheets can be used for a lot of stuff. And he just used an Excel spreadsheet, and it has information in there about the evidence, about the people who had any kind of connection to the Ramsey case, whether it be neighbors, people who phoned in tips, sex offenders that were in the area at the time. They are all on a list. And on that list, it shows whether police took their DNA, whether they took their blood, their saliva, fingerprints, handwriting samples. It has information next to the name. It gives a little bit of a taste of what the connection is to the case. There's a link from that into another database that kind of has all of the messages, emails, phone calls, police reports, or, you know, like a sex offender list might be tied to this person. Just the information that kind of backs up why they're on that spreadsheet.
Cindy believes that JonBenet's murderer is on that spreadsheet.
We feel confident that the name of the killer is on that list. It's just a matter of, for our purposes, getting their DNA and testing it. That's how we feel we can contribute to this whole thing. You know, we're not investigating the case at this point because Lou did all the investigation already. So we're just going with what he left us.
It is a painstaking process.
We try to look at it and figure out how we should prioritize them. So from what we have to do is just kind of figure out, okay, you know, who should we go for? And then we have to track them down. And then we have to figure out how to get their DNA. We've done it various ways. We've sent them letters asking for them to fill out a form. And they return it and we use the envelope. Somebody sent us a postcard that had a stamp on it. And they would have looked that stamp. Kent was quite the DNA catcher with one of the suspects where we were at a market. And we followed this guy around and he ate something and threw remnants in the trash. And Kent just dove into that trash and got that. And then we saw him get a drink and drink out of a straw. And he threw that in a trash can. And Kent basically jumped in the trash can to go get it.
I love solving puzzles. That's what true crime is to me, after all, just one big puzzle. When I want to take a break from the dark stuff, though, I like to lighten up my puzzle time with Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game where every level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story, one you get to take part in. I love that the game is challenging while not being frustrating. The best part for me is when I have to choose the fiends I want on my team for each level. I have to make sure I'm playing the best fiends possible based on their skill sets, and since every level is different, it requires me to choose wisely for every challenge. The more I play, the more fun it gets. Plus, you don't need the internet to play, so anytime I want a little entertainment, Best Fiends is my go-to. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play online. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
For Cindy, DNA is the key to solving the case.
Yeah, because we've decided, I remember my dad, before he died, just, you know, he would kind of talk about the case and talk about what should be done. And he says, you know, I think I'm just going to start asking people if they'll give their DNA. All they can say is no. And so that's always stuck with me. And so we decided that that's what we would do. We would just try and track these people down. I mean, it's been 23 years. So part of the problem is just tracking down these people. People have died. People are no longer at their last known address. So we just decided that we would try that first. Just see if they're willing to give their DNA.
Some of the people on your dad's list and some of the people we're looking at, they're in prison. I mean, they have a sexual assault background, and some of them are in prison, some for life, several of them. And I don't know whether the prisons routinely like put their DNA into a system.
Well, and that's just what we don't know. We would like to know that, but we just kind of hear different stories about that, that theoretically they're supposed to. Their DNA is supposed to be put into CODIS. But I don't know whether people who have been in there since the 70s, whether they do that, they go back and get all these inmates' DNA. I don't know. So we just have to assume that they don't.
And all of you, I mean, you and your husband, I mean, you work full-time. This isn't your...
Yeah, almost everybody on our team has full-time jobs. So we don't, you know, we might take a weekend and go after a suspect and try and get DNA, but that's few and far between.
It comes out of your own pocket? Have you been able to raise money?
Yeah, so we were paying what we needed to pay. And then we just decided that we were just going to try a GoFundMe. And it's under the name JonBenet, Lou Smith's Family Searches for Justice. And we've been able to raise money that way that we're using towards these expenses. Then we went on Dr. Oz, and they promoted it. And so we got a really good response to it. So now we have some money that can pay these expenses. And, you know, that's all we're using it for, is just to pay the lab fees, to pay, you know, now we have some investigators that can track down these people. We have to pay them. We've had investigators try and contact some of the people to see if they'll willingly give their DNA. So we're kind of just figuring out how we can best utilize that money so that we're not trying to do this ourselves.
In the late 1990s, DNA profiling was still in its relatively early stages. Detective John San Augustine describes what samples were taken at the time.
There was some samples that were taken, my understanding, from JonBenet's underwear, under her fingernails, and I believe also on her long johns. In fact, what we also know, really 2 weeks after the murder of JonBenet, there's a report that was done by CBI.
Tell us who CBI is.
So the Colorado Bureau of Investigation actually did some of the initial DNA analysis in the very beginning of the investigation. An analyst by the name of Catherine Dressel does some comparison using, at the time it was what they call DQ alpha of typing of DNA. And from that typing, they found out, or she found out, that the major component matched JonBenet, but the minor component did not match anybody in the family. And this included Patsy Ramsey, John Andrew Ramsey, Burke Ramsey. It went through a litany of people that were tied to the family and found that none of that DNA, in particular in this one, it was under her fingernails, did not match anybody in the family. When you look at the DNA in this, what you cannot say is that there's an innocent explanation for why you would have foreign DNA on her long johns, on her underwear, and under her fingernails, of which is all the same source. I would tell you, in my experience of almost two decades of law enforcement experience, that if there was a suspect whose DNA matched the victim's underwear, long johns, and under her fingernails, that person would rise to the top as being a suspect because, you know, she's sexually assaulted. There's DNA found near her underwear. She has, you know, DNA on her long johns. And obviously from the strangulation, she may have potentially grabbed at the perpetrator or perpetrators. We don't know. But what we do know is that there's a foreign DNA, minor component of DNA that was found under her fingernails that does not match anybody in the family. So there's no innocent explanation for that.
Although some DNA testing was done after JonBenet's murder, many potentially crucial items from the murder scene remain untested.
Bode Technologies receives five items from the Boulder District Attorney's Office, of which they only test one. They give the results to Mary Keenan, who immediately, you know, says that the family is not involved. Unfortunately, the remaining four items were not subsequently tested to develop a profile or a potential profile from those four other items.
Is that okay, or should...
No. I mean, none of this is okay. I mean, that's why, you know, we're in the state that we're in right now, 23 years later. And, you know, items like that should have been tested as well, because there's a high probability. Obviously, when they selected these five items, they thought there was a high probability that there would be a DNA profile developed from them. So why not have those additional four items tested so that we can develop a profile from those additional items? It may match the first item, it may not. But the bottom line is, you know, we've been at a standstill for the last 23 years and as far as identifying a potential suspect, when you have items, and you know, that's just four other items of the five that they initially picked. I will tell you, there are hundreds of other items that could potentially be retested, you know, brought into current technology to see how, you know, if anything, that a profile can be developed from these items.
And if they need more DNA, we believe that they have several items that haven't been tested.
Or parts of those items have been tested and other parts have not been tested.
This is JonBenet Ramsey expert, Jameson.
When they test the cord, they test a small segment of it. And the question is, have they untied the knots? That's one question that has been asked. Because when you take that cord and you wrap it around the piece of wood, you're gripping it and it's passing through your skin. And so there's a chance that there's better DNA on the cord in that twist and knot. And we don't know that they've unknotted it.
Testing these items could prove crucial to finding the killer.
The testing of the one item in 2008 got some results.
Correct.
I would imagine, though, I mean, we all know, by 2019, without even being a DNA scientist, you know it's advanced, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, what we definitely know is that 23 years later after the fact, you know, we've gone from a very antiquated way of typing DNA to where today, you know, they're able to get DNA off of samples without having to see visually a blood sample or a seminal sample or a saliva sample. They literally can swab a specific area of an article of clothing or, you know, an eyeglass or a cap or whatever. They can literally swab those areas and get touch DNA from those specific areas. And, you know, they're able to get DNA literally from anything now. So it's come a long way.
As Detective John San Augustine explains, advances in DNA profiling technology mean that today, even tiny samples can yield hugely detailed results.
They've also been able to do things to where they can tie it to a particular family. So now, you know, when you look at, okay, 1996, how many people named John Doe lived in Boulder at the time of this deal? Now you can start kind of, you know, focus more attention into that because the science is giving you, you know, a specific family, a specific familial piece, which, you know, in 96, nobody knew about that. So now, you know, it may be something where there's a name that is attributed to this DNA that was on JonBenet. And now it's a matter of, okay, was there somebody potentially who was incarcerated that was recently let go? Somebody with a sexual, you know, some type of pedophilia background that was let go? And it could be somebody from out of the state. We don't know. But the fact that this familial piece is a known, we may be able to find, you know, the killer based on just that. Then you look at that and then you say, okay, where was that individual in December of 1996? Was he in the Boulder area? Who did he associate with? Did he rent a car? You know, did he have a cell phone? Did he have something that may tie us even closer? Then, you know, do we have any article of clothing that he has now that matches up with something maybe? You know, again, there's a lot of things that we can do with the help of law enforcement to further that investigation.
Here's Cindy Mara.
I think that the smartest thing that they could do is do the genealogy testing.
Tell me what that would mean.
That would mean that they have to send in the DNA to get tested under today's, I don't know if it's called today's standards, I don't know what the technical term is, but the Bode report isn't sufficient to be for those genealogical places to be able to do the genealogical research. It has to be tested under whatever process they use. And that's what they put into that database. So, you know, only Boulder can do that because, like, we don't have DNA. So they would have to do that. And basically, that's it. And they could send it to Parabon Labs, to Bodhi Labs, because Parabon Labs also, you know, they're able to do the composite of what the person looked like. Parabon Labs can do phenotyping, and they need DNA to do that.
And what would that do then?
They come up with a composite of what the person probably looked like.
Yeah.
You know, the features and stuff.
The color of the eyes. They can, they go into the actual genes. They supposedly can get the color of the eyes, the shape of the nose, the shape of the chin.
Right.
They can get that detail and actually come up with a...
Why wouldn't you do it?
Why wouldn't you do it?
Right.
Investigative reporter Paula Woodward.
I have tried to find out whether or not the Boulder Police Department is actively pursuing genetic DNA, and I haven't been able to get an answer. So I don't know. I find it strange that they wouldn't say they were if they were, but then a lot of what they have done has been strange. Including, are you looking at genetic DNA to try to track who the killer might be and then not getting an answer? To me, that's very basic.
Here's JonBenet's father, John Ramsey.
There's two issues. One is that is only accessible by the police. We can't do that as private citizens. Secondly, we understand that there's items of evidence that were never tested the killer potentially could have touched, and that needs to be done. I think in terms of moving it forward, if we can get the Boulder Police to test the evidence that hadn't been tested for DNA, we understand that there were five pieces sent in for testing to the DNA lab. Only one or two were tested. The other three, I assume, were returned back to the police evidence files. If we can take those three pieces, have them tested, see what DNA is on there. You know, these things that the killer obviously had to touch.
JonBenet's stepbrother, John Andrew Ramsey, is optimistic that DNA will provide the breakthrough.
One, we have the killer's DNA. Let's start there. So that's hugely important and will ultimately solve this crime. And two, yes, there are additional items that should be tested, you know, given today's new technology, for additional samples. And then three, yeah, I mean, the, you know, advent of using genealogy to identify a killer is hugely promising. And that technology will only get better, right? I mean, from where we were in 1996 to where we are today, it's been just leaps and bounds, an improvement in the DNA technology. So in my mind, if it's not today, it's tomorrow. We're gonna crack this. I'm absolutely confident in that. I think they, like others, see DNA as central to solving this crime and have been quietly collecting samples from people on that suspect list in the hopes of either ruling people out or, of course, finding the killer. So it's a process that sometimes is transparent to the suspect, or you just call and ask them, and sometimes it's not. It's the, you know, collections of coffee cups and chewing gum kind of thing.
Jonathan Webb was a member of the grand jury convened in 1998 to consider the JonBenet case. Over 20 years later, he also remains frustrated by the lack of comprehensive DNA testing.
And if it's not DNA evidence, it was certainly fingerprint evidence. Because we did talk about that. And to me, you take an older home and you think about personnel that will come in and do maintenance work because you have a bad, you know, sump pump or whatever. It's not surprising you would find DNA or fingerprints that don't match up with anybody that anyone knows. With the touch DNA. So who touched the letter? And if somebody writes a letter, their hand is usually on the side of the piece of paper. So that DNA is going to be all over that paper. That's one way to say things. The other thing is that JonBenet was assaulted with an inanimate object. If that is still available, it's likely, if the person wasn't wearing gloves, that there's touch DNA on that. There's probably a host of other evidence, because there was, I believe it was a bat found outside the home that was possibly the weapon. There's was a golf club, other things. You know, if you have the golf club and say, let's assume for a second that the golf club was the weapon, that would have JonBenet's DNA on the head of that golf club. And I can tell you this, is that I'm a neophyte in this, but you get crime experts that know the technology and have the evidence that's well preserved, I believe it could be solved.
In 2018, detectives in California used advances in DNA profiling to finally solve what was called the Golden State Killer case, charging 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo with 8 counts of murder and 13 related kidnapping and abduction attempts stretching back to the mid-1970s.
Genetic DNA is DNA that spreads throughout the family and can identify particular individuals in the family. That is something that has developed recently. It's how California law enforcement people tracked down the Golden State Killer, and that was a huge big deal. They did it by going to these genetic websites where family were listing their DNA. DNA from family members can be traced to a certain individual in the family. Websites are listing this DNA, and police and law enforcement investigators in California found and traced the Golden State Killer, and they arrested him. And they did it by going to these family websites and tracing the DNA back to this person.
John Ramsey and John San Augustine are in no doubt that the same techniques can be used to find JonBenet's killer.
My understanding of familial DNA is that you can submit a sample of DNA, and based on the characteristics of that DNA, they meaning the companies that are into this, like 23andMe, Ancestry.com, that they're able to see exactly where that DNA makeup is as far as the world is concerned.
What the police did, I believe it was in Sacramento, is they took the DNA sample they had from the crime scene, and rather than just comparing it to the FBI CODIS database, which is fairly small, they went to the public arena, the Ancestry.com, the various sites you can go on and for $35 check and have your DNA sampled and give you some information on where you came from. They went to that public database, which I believe is hundreds of millions of samples, and ran their crime scene DNA sample against that database. And they found someone that was a family member, because of the DNA wasn't exact match, but there's some similarities in the markers. They then went and worked forward in the family tree several generations, found that, okay, here's somebody that was related, that lived in Sacramento at the time of this horrendous murder spree, went, found the guy, got his DNA, it was a perfect match. And they arrested him and they solved the Golden State Killer case, which had been dead for 40 years. It was a major piece of police work, very clever. I'm sure it was a lot of work. But the problem with the FBI database, it's fairly small. Some states don't even contribute to it. You only get in that database if you've, in some states, if you've committed a felony. In some states, it's only after you're released from prison that they put your DNA in the database. So it's a small population relative to, you know, the total population of the country. So it needs to be done in our case. Absolutely.
What did your dad think?
He thought DNA would solve this case.
And so that's where we're coming from with this, with what we're doing, is we're taking his cue that DNA will solve the case, and getting DNA and testing DNA.
But DNA alone is not enough. Whatever the results show, they must be married to good old-fashioned detective work. Detective John San Augustine explains.
You have to be careful that you put all your eggs just in the DNA basket, because no investigation, no murder investigation, ever revolves around just one piece of evidence. However, this is a crucial piece of evidence, and we need to see whose DNA that is. So the question is now, you know, what do we do with this DNA evidence? Actually, what should Boulder PD or the Boulder DA's office do with this DNA evidence? We have the technology today to identify what race we're dealing with. We can identify as maybe even a specific name. So there's a lot of things that are currently, you know, being developed, some that have already been developed, and we've come a long way since 1996. Here we are 23 years later. We need to think outside the box. We need to be able to look at these companies and say, look, we need your help. We have a profile. What can you tell me about that profile today that may lead to the killer or killers of JonBenet?
For our team, it's time to get in the field. Next time on The Killing of JonBenet Ramsey, The Final Suspects, confronting the first two names on Lou Smith's list.
One of the, I'm told, important things to look for is a motive in any killing. And this one person had a potential motive in that the mother, who worked for my company, was caught embezzling a fair amount of money. And we terminated her. So we thought, well, there's a motive for a relative, a husband, you know, angry at whomever got her put in prison.
The Killing of JonBenet, The Final Suspects, is hosted by me, Danielle Robay. Executive produced by Dylan Howard and Matt Sprouse, and is a production of Broad and Water Studios and Endeavor Audio. Executive producers also include Tom Freestone, Doug Longini, Susan Bennett, James Robertson, and Andy Tillett. The series is written by Dominic Utten, reporting by Doug Montero. The series is mixed and engineered by Sean Kravitz and Sam Ada. There is so much more to this story, and you don't want to miss anything, I can assure you. Subscribe to The Killing of JonBenet, The Final Suspects, wherever you get podcasts. If you have information that could help our investigators and the Ramseys identify JonBenet's killer, please email us at tips@justiceforjonbenet.com.